Hi, this is Lauren Schiller, and I hope you enjoy the conversations you hear each week on Inflection Point. If there's one thing I've learned from doing this show, and I probably knew it already, you have to ask for what you want. And we want to go national. So I'm asking you to become a patron of Inflection Point. For just 50 cents an interview, you can be a part of bringing women who are changing the status quo to the ears of everyone. That's only $4 a month, about the price of a latte. $4 to ensure that the views and voices of powerful women are heard every week. With your patronage, we can make it happen. Go to inflectionpointradio.org and thank you. Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, as women continue to push for equality in the workplace, the reception isn't always so grand. But what's really holding us back?
We still associate female authority with childhood, and we haven't seen enough women in authority in the world outside the home to feel that it's natural and okay.
Writer, activist, and social entrepreneur Gloria Steinem has been the face of the women's movement since many of us were born, and she is still advocating on our behalf. She founded Ms. Magazine and the Ms. Foundation and has won many awards for her journalism. In 2013, Gloria Steinem received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama. She has also written a number of books, including her latest, My Life on the Road. We reached her at her home in New York. Welcome, Gloria Steinem.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
It almost goes without saying that you're an icon of the feminist movement. How do you think feminism has changed since you got involved in the women's movement?
That's a very big question.
We start big here.
Describe the universe in two examples. <right? laughs> I suppose part of it remains the same, which is just the simple dictionary idea that we are all human beings and we believe in the full equality of men and women of all groups. And also, that simplicity is still dawning on us with great complexity as to what it means in every area of life and how fundamental it is and how much it transforms. It's also changed from a few people to a majority of people in the U.S. and in many other countries. Not that the institutions have changed as they should, but that the majority consciousness, at least, has changed to believe that the principle of equality is equal and desirable. That means that there is also a backlash now, because becoming a frontlash, you might say, becoming a majority consciousness change means that we're now considered a serious threat to those folks who have been making unfair profits off unequal pay, or even at a more deep level, who firmly believe that reproduction, women's bodies, the sort of basic decisions of life should be in male hands, not in female hands, sometimes for patriarchal reasons, sometimes additionally for racist reasons, since in order to maintain racial difference or difference of caste or class, you have to control reproduction. So we both have succeeded and are now on a kind of knife edge of whether it will continue or not in the way that it should, because we have become a serious transforming promise to some people and threat to others.
So those who see feminism as a threat are digging in their heels even further, you mean?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can see that by the successive waves of legislative, physical, and now procedural violence, and also physical violence against Planned Parenthood, for instance, and by the nature of our two political parties, one of which has been taken over by an extreme right-wing group.
Well, in the book, you call yourself an entrepreneur for social change. What do you mean by that?
Well, I never quite am able to explain to what an organizer does unless somebody has already been or seen organizing. So that's the best way. Perhaps we can evolve a better way today. But the entrepreneur is seen as someone who takes disparate elements that haven't been put together before and puts them together in a new way to create something innovative and necessary. And I do think that's at least one description of what a wide variety of organizers do.
You talk in the book about before Houston and after Houston and mm-hmm. and your role there at the Women's Conference. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I think, as I say in the book, I think Houston is the most important event nobody knows about because it really was a constitutional convention for the female half of the United States. There had been meetings in every state and territory, some as massive as, say, in New York State, there were 20,000 people just at the preparatory meeting, electing representatives, electing delegates, and deciding on issues to bring up at the national meeting. And after 2 years of that process, which was very carefully inclusive so that it was maybe the only racially, economically, ethnically representative process that I've seen in this country, there was a mammoth meeting of 2,000 delegates and many thousands of observers in Houston where we thrashed out issues and voted. It really did bring the women's movement together around issues that before might have been viewed as not representing the whole movement or controversial, like reproductive freedom as a basic right, including safe and legal abortion, or like discrimination against lesbians as a feminist issue for all women in and of itself. And we did all come together in the majority around an agenda there. So, you know, the behavior of the movement really changed profoundly and became a majority movement then.
And what year was that?
I have to think, 77, I believe.
77.
Yeah.
So that is the same year that the Equal Rights Amendment had a march on Washington.
Yes, it was just about the time when the deadline was coming up and we got an extension since three more states, there were more states and three more had to ratify.
I was there.
Oh, great.
My mom and her friends took me on a bus from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, down to D.C. to be part of that march. And that amendment has still yet to be passed. It didn't pass then, and it hasn't yet passed. Do you think that the Equal Rights Amendment is still relevant?
Yes, it definitely is relevant. It's reemerging again. Relevant in every way, since the women are still not part of the Constitution, just the word women is not there, but in a very practical way. For instance, you may remember the massive sex discrimination suit against Walmart, which was actually the biggest class action suit in history. It lost not because we could not prove that women were discriminated against, but because we could not prove state of mind, that is, that it was on purpose. If we had had the Equal Rights Amendment, we wouldn't have had to prove state of mind. And there are many, many other situations that demonstrate that we still need it. Since then, the right-wing backlash has taken over Congress to a greater degree, so it's not going to be easy to get it through Congress again, much less through all the state legislatures. But there is a new ERA movement booming, and there is a good new book out by Jessica Neuwirth about the Equal Rights Amendment and why we need it, a slender, practical, interesting book from the New Press.
Well, the women's movement is also really focused on increasing the number of women in leadership. Do you think this is overshadowing some of the more fundamental issues that something like the Equal Rights Amendment would cover, like sexism, but also worker protection, racism, I mean, all these fundamental issues? That,
you know, we live in a somewhat hierarchical culture, so the idea that the most important thing is to break the glass ceiling is more likely to be covered than that it affects more women's lives to get off the sticky floor, you might say, of the pink collar ghetto. So I agree with you that entry into corporate leadership or political leadership probably gets more attention from the outside world. But I think from the inside world, it's really at least equal, or maybe the other way around. And if you look now at the massive movements for immigrant rights, say, because immigrants are, of course, mostly women and their kids, or for the rights of household workers, you know, and we are achieving that state by state and sometimes city by city, you can see that there's at least as much effort there. I'm not enough. Nothing is ever enough, but as much effort.
Do you think there's a cadence that we should be following? Like, there are some issues that we need to tackle before we can move on to other issues?
I think that the answer is really, most importantly, answered by individual women in their lives. You know, can they feed their kids? That's the most important issue. Are they experiencing domestic violence? That's the most important issue. You know, I don't think we should try to impose an agenda of urgency on real life, because, for one thing, we're at our strongest when we are working on the issues we know the best. But it is obvious collectively that the two questions, one, violence against females in the world at large, which has become so severe, whether it's domestic violence in the U.S. or sexualized violence in war zones or son preference in many parts of Asia, for instance, that has produced a son surplus and a daughter deficit, FGM, child marriage, too early pregnancy as a cause of death. All of these have added up to the fact that for the first time now that we know of, there are fewer females on Earth than males.
I did not know that.
Yes.
We're no longer 51%?
Not of the world at large, no. So, you know, that certainly the question of violence against females is deep and urgent, not only for women, which would be enough, but for everybody, since it turns out that violence against females is the biggest predictor of all other violence. It tends to be what is experienced first and normalizes other violence, makes us grow up believing that it's natural or even inevitable for one group to dominate the other. So it's the biggest indicator of violence in the streets of a country, and also whether that country will be willing to use military violence against another country.
Gloria, you dedicate a number of pages in your book to what we can learn from the Native American culture and from Gandhi. Can any of that help us with this?
Yes, absolutely. I don't want to dictate what helps whom, because we all have different entry points, but it certainly helped me to know that probably most of human history, and certainly in North and South America, the earliest cultures are matrilineal. Women controlled their own fertility by herbs and abortifacients. It was just natural, since it's women's bodies and women's health, to decide when and whether to have children. Women tended also to control agriculture while men hunted, but those two things were considered equally necessary. In many of the cultures, the Native American cultures here, female elders decided if it was necessary to go to war or when to make peace. They chose the male leaders. They were part of a circular, consultative, consensus-seeking government form that was profoundly democratic. The women in Indian country who I came to know, who I've come to know over the years, I mean, you can only survive terrible tragedies if you can occasionally laugh. So they make jokes about, what did Columbus think was primitive? Equal women.
Oh.
I mean, and of course, there's much tragedy behind that. I mean, among the first things he did was to take sex slaves for his crew, and was just astounded that women fought back.
Well, you spent some time in India earlier in your life and learned a lot about Gandhian practices.
Yes, that was just pure happenstance in my life. I'm so grateful for it because I kind of fled to India in order not to get married, and I was engaged to a very nice guy, but clearly it wouldn't have been right for either of us to get married. And because I was there and just voyaging in that way you do when you're young and you don't know what you're doing at all, I had the good luck to end up traveling, walking with Gandhian groups, and of course just the atmosphere, because it was only about a decade or so after independence, was very full of the wisdom and effectiveness of Gandhian methods of organizing, even though the country itself, of course, had gone through, despite those methods, gone through a violent partition. So in a way, the nonviolence was even more valued. However, what I learned, which is just the simple lessons of organizing, which if you want people to listen to you, you have to listen to them. If you want to know how people live, you have to go where they live. Everybody needs to tell their stories, sitting in a circle, being listened to, in order to have a community of support and change. It's just fundamental ground-up lessons. But I didn't understand that they would be useful in my own country. It took me a while after I came home and saw the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and then the women's movement to understand that these were universal guidelines.
Well, your book is full of wonderful anecdotes about individuals that you've met while on the road, including your experience in India. And it's so specific, and it covers such a, you know, covers your life so far. And I was just wondering how you remembered everything.
Well,
and what your
all,
process was
I
like
mean,
to write it.
Here's the process, because I do not want to make it seem that I have any special abilities. I don't.
I was impressed.
First of all, it's so intense on the road that I have never been able to keep a journal. Even when I take notes, they always turn out to be the wrong notes. So I depend on my memory to curate, you might say, emotionally. You know, what I remember emotionally, I then go back to and research if necessary. You know, I've write what I remember, send it to people who were also there. I made heavy use of Google to find out dates and places because I would remember the people in the narrative, but not necessarily the nouns and the dates, you know, to tell the story the way it happened.
Well, you recount some great retorts in your book. When you went on the speaking circuit, you came up against people who heckled you.
That was Flo Kennedy coming up with her memorable retorts. She was very much better at it than I was.
What were some of your favorites?
Well, my all-time favorite was that when we were in the South and audiences had some pretty conservative components, sooner or later some guy would rise up in the back, and you know, because it was fairly unusual for a white woman and a black woman to be touring together, and would say, "Are you lesbians?" And she always said, "Are you my alternative?" Which made the audience laugh and caused him to sit down without, because we didn't want to say no, because it seemed like deserting, you know, women who are lesbians, and to say yes wouldn't have been true. So she found the perfect answer.
Oh, it's always good to have some of those in your back pocket.
Yes.
Well, the whole first chapter of your book is about your dad. Could you share some of the influence he had on the values that you hold now about equality and how we treat one another?
I had outlined what I thought would be the book, but without the chapter on my father. And yet when I sat down to actually write it in a solitary place, the chapter about my father came first. At the time that we were living in a house trailer, which was until the time I was 10. He had a summer resort in southern Michigan, but when it got cold, which he couldn't bear, he would put us in a house trailer and we would work our way buying and selling small antiques to Florida or California. At the time, I wanted to go to school like other kids, like, you know, have a life I saw in the movies. So I didn't realize how much it was influencing me and how much it enabled me to live with insecurity, which every freelance writer needs to be able to do, and also just to cherish and feel at home with that kind of uncertainty of the road and that kind of glorious uncertainty of the road. So in that way that you discover things about yourself while you're writing a book, I discovered how much I had recreated in my own way my father's life.
Well, do you think, I mean, just thinking about dads and their influence on daughters, do you think that we need more men in the women's movement now? And how should we get them
involved?
Well,
we need more everybody, you know, women and men. And I think there are way, way, way more men now who really understand that we are all prisoners of gender, you know, that gender actually is made up, that we're all human beings, we're all both unique and share human qualities at the same time, and that their prison may be a superior prison with people to serve you coffee and so on, but it is still a prison. So there are many, many more men who are supportive for themselves, you know, because they also want to be closer to their children or see their daughters respected for their talents or understand that violence against women is a root of other violence, you know, for whatever reason. There are many more. It has a particular role to play for women when it comes to our fathers, because I began to realize as I saw some dear and beloved friends who are women of great talent and strength who had grown up with dictatorial or cold or distant or even violent and sexually abusive fathers who, given that deep experience, were still trying to work that out by getting a cold or distant man to respond to them, or just because they didn't deeply believe there were choices. So I began to realize how lucky I was to have had a father who, however profoundly irresponsible he was about money and other things, loved me, liked my company, asked me my opinions. So I knew that there were men like that in the world.
Well, let's talk about something that was probably inconceivable as you were growing up, which is a woman president. In your book, you talk about Hillary Clinton's first run for president, and you say that you didn't think the country was ready for a woman to be president. Do you think that we are now?
Well, this country is pretty big and disparate, but I think enough people are now so that it would be possible to elect her or another pro-equality woman. I did not think so when she ran the first time, even though I supported her, not because her views were different from Obama's. They were really very much the same, those two good people. But she had a lot more experience. So I thought, you know, we could have 8 years of Hillary and then 8 years of Obama, as opposed to what I now hope to be the other way around. But I supported her because of her greater experience. But in my heart, I thought that probably because we are women and men so much raised by women, that we still associate female authority with childhood, and we haven't seen enough women in authority in the world outside the home to feel that it's natural and okay, you know, to feel secure with it. I do think that that's changed, certainly not completely, but enough so that this time she might be able to get elected, but it will be difficult.
I wonder if men are given the opportunity to spend more time at home, if that will also change the way we think about
what
leadership
absolutely.
Looks like.
No, I think that's crucial. No, thank you for saying that, because it is as crucial, if maybe even more so, for men to play an equal role in raising kids, because that's how men become whole people. That's how they develop the patience, attention to detail, empathy, all these qualities that are wrongly called feminine but are present in all human beings. And they get to be fully human. That's crucial.
Well, thinking about your life on the road, you talk about an on the road state of mind. Any tips on how we can all attain that?
You know, I've since I finish the book, I've come to think, you know, all during the time I was writing the book, I was occasionally trying to learn to meditate. I went to courses. All my friends who told me how important it was completely convinced me that that experience of living in the present, whether you want to call it mindfulness or meditation, was really very helpful. And somehow I never integrated it into my life. And because the book caused me to be more introspective, I began to realize that actually the road is my form of meditation because it forces you to live in the present. If you're open, if you stay open to the changing things around you, it does force you to live in the present.
Well, I wrap up every interview and conversation with a question about advice. So here's my question for you. What's the best advice about starting a movement that you've ever received?
Tell the truth about what has happened to you that you think is unique. Maybe you fear it's uniquely your fault, or maybe you think it's a form of injustice that is isolated, or whatever it is. Tell the truth about what has happened to you, even to small groups of people, and chances are that you will discover that a version of that has happened to other people too. And since we are each of us unique, that means that the shared experience, the pattern of shared experience, is political. And if we get together, we can change it for each other. I think that is the root, the real durable, revelatory root of change that must come from the bottom up in order to be true to our lives.
Well, Gloria Steinem, thank you for sharing this experience with all of us.
No, thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Gloria Steinem. Her new book is My Life on the Road. As part of this week's Inflection Point, listen to our interview with Lena Nielsen, an engineer who wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times called How to Attract Female Engineers.
Why does it matter how many women are engineers? Why are so many people so obsessed with this kind of stuff? Maybe, just maybe, the male brain is better at engineering than the female brain. That, to me, is the obvious answer.
Thank you, Liz Scarborough, Al Sadanaga, and Sabrina Moyle, for supporting us at inflectionpointradio.org.
I move the adoption of the following resolution. The Equal Rights Amendment should be ratified.
A special report from Houston, Texas, on the 1977 National Women's Conference.
And I watched this morning the corruption of young people in Albert Thomas Hall. And the greatest tragedy of all was to see two former first ladies and the current wife of the President of the United States all sitting properly with their hands in their lap and standing by their very presence alongside of Abzug approving of sexual perversion and the murder of young people in their mother's wombs. What a disgrace!
The women's movement has become an indestructible part of American life. It is the homemaker deciding that raising children, cleaning and cooking, and all the other things she does for her family is work that should be accorded respect and value. It is the young woman student asserting that she wants to play baseball, carry a torch, major in physics, or become a brain surgeon. It is the working woman demanding that she get the same pay and promotion opportunities as a man. It is a divorced woman fighting for Social Security benefits in her own right. It is the widow embarking on a new career. It is the mother organizing a daycare center. It is the battered wife seeking help. It is the woman running for public office. It's the woman on welfare looking for a decent part of American society.
That's our Inflection Point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. follow us. And follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.